Okay, so this is Nobody Cares, a special episode about Patrick Kennelly, for who's here to talk to us about his movie Excess Flesh and other stuff. Patrick Kennelly, hi.
Hi.
You co-wrote Excess Flesh with Sigrid Gilmer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie that stars Bethany Hoare and Mary Loveless.
Mm-hmm.
First, because I'm completely terrible at it, can you pitch your movie for us so the listeners have a basic understanding of it?
It's two characters who are sort of in their like late 20s, early 30s, Jennifer and Jill, and they're roommates, and they live in Los Angeles. And basically, Jennifer is the one who sort of like has it all, you know, the sort of the personality, and is starting to rise up in the fashion industry. And Jill is her friend who's just come from New York and can't leave the house and is sort of like closed in her own space and idealizes and hates. I'm going on really long here.
No, it's okay, go. It's a podcast, it's meant to be long.
But basically they're sort of like love-hate relationship and an abusive sort of relationship that spirals out of control. That's basically it, without giving too much away.
If you haven't seen the movie, please watch it before listening to the podcast. We're going to go into stuff that will spoil the movie for you.
Yes, so spoiler alert, watch the movie.
So the most obvious thematics that are the injunction on a female to fit a certain ideal, as well as eating disorders, which are traditionally thought of as female stuff, even though it's not the case. How come you, as a guy, wrote about it? Can you tell us a bit about the genesis of the movie?
The idea first came up about a decade ago. I had written sort of like a one-page sort of thing of what this movie was. I had the title and the sort of outline. Originally, they weren't roommates.
Okay.
It was this person she saw from afar. But we changed it into roommates when we actually wrote the script. And I had... And this is before... XXL, that short film. How do you pronounce that director's name? Xavier Gens.
I have no idea.
He's French. He's a French director.
Oh, he's French. Yeah. So it must be Xavier Jean. I haven't seen that particular segment of. It's a segment of ABCs of Death.
Yes. Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And so yeah. Everybody on the internet tells you when it's like...
It has nothing to do with that.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with that.
But it did start sort of as a short idea, and then when we actually started getting into the writing, we got like 40 pages in, and I sort of realized actually we have a whole movie here. This would be exciting to explore, really go in depth in some of the ideas, and also to have a feature film that was basically in one space with two people for the entire. The entire time. But what happens is like I generally start a project from a very conceptual place, where more intellectual. It's from the, you know, the different ideas and that I've had over time and research and all these things, and then they sort of like converge. And once the process begins, then and it moves along, then I understand why I'm doing it, you know, how it relates to me. So it's a learning process. What I think is something that's outside of myself, like eating disorders and all that stuff, then once I explore the idea, I realize, there's more connecting here personally than sort of, you know, that. I like to do projects where I can learn about a subject and this outside of myself, you know, because that's the most exciting part, and that's always what I've done. You know, works about women or African Americans, and the history of all these things, and then I get to learn, but it also becomes a very, very personal endeavor. I can sort of project myself, through these models,
Well, okay, so the cast is also particularly impressive. What was the casting process like, and did you write the script having one or both of the actress in mind?
No, I never. We never really do that. It's you know, creating the characters and then finding the. But there's been sometimes where smaller sort of things I've kind of written for. Even in this movie, there were actors who came in the casting process, and we really liked them, but we didn't have a part for them, so we created a part specifically for that character.
Like which characters?
Well, in the longer version, she's very small now. We were creating all these kind of like side relationships with the people that she works with in the model house, the fashion house.
Yeah.
And then there was this girl that you see during the party scene that is like the girlfriend of the African-American woman.
Okay.
Who comes to the door and she sees at the end who's her like co-worker. And there was this actress who and so that character wasn't in it. There wasn't even this idea that she was a girlfriend there and all that stuff. And that's explored way more in depth in the longer version. But
I want to see the director's cut.
Yeah, the director's cut is very much the same, you know, the same ideas, but different, like structurally and all these kind of side things that really aren't relevant to the actual main story. But anyways, that character came because there's this actress who was actually auditioning for the neighbor part, and she didn't really fit what we were imagining, but she was so exciting that we wrote that part for her. And the character's name, the actress's name.
Okay.
We usually do that. It's like, in a project, it starts with a certain number of characters, and then it splinters off and becomes more characters, and that's because there's, like, either somebody that I'm really excited about or one of my collaborators is really excited about working with, and we model something for them.
Okay.
But that doesn't happen until later, after the writing of this. So we wrote it, and my co-writer thought of Mary Lovelace for the part of Jennifer, and I was like, yeah, that's actually kind of perfect. We both went to school with her.
Yeah.
Sigrid was a playwright. I was studying film and video and visual art, and Mary was an actress. And I didn't even know if she was still living in Los Angeles or was still acting, and so I looked her up, and she was, and I reached out to her, and so we kind of, that started really early, even before we were gonna like cast the movie.
Because Mary is kind of a bitch.
No, but just the idea that we have for the character and what we'd seen her do before as an actress is sort of, and her handle of language and that sort of training was really, really ideal for this particular character.
She's great. I love both the actresses.
And Bethany was somebody we discovered in the casting process.
Yeah,
I mean, really, the character was written in a different sort of way, or we were imagining a different kind of actress. But when Bethany came in, the casting director told me, "You have to watch this film that she's wrote and directed."
Yeah, Agorable. We talked about it in one of. When we reviewed Excess Flesh, we also talked about Agorable, and I really liked it, and that's why I was so startled. Well, I was really surprised because it felt perfect. It felt like it was meant to be her.
Yeah. Of course, because when I saw that, I was like, wow, this is this actress that I think I can, you know, the one I've been looking for to work with, to go on this journey. And I met with her, and we really just, like hit it off. And so then the character sure shifted a little bit from how it was written. But, I mean, it remained there, and her tension off of Mary was just great.
They had great chemistry.
Yeah.
It's weird to call it chemistry, but it's chemistry.
Yeah. And
even
they have completely
destructive one.
Yeah, and they're completely different in real life and have different acting styles too.
Yeah.
So it was interesting putting those.
It's great because they play off they play a lot out of each other, you know. Mm-hmm. They go great together and bounce on each other's reaction really well, so it's interesting to know that. So the film also has a very specific texture or feel built through colors, sound design, editing and photography. Was it something that you already had in mind from the beginning when you started writing it, or was it constructed progressively as the movie got made? Also, do you have any influences in mind when crafting that feel?
Well, yes and no. The design of it was. Wait, what was the first part of the question?
The film has a very specific texture or feel built through some colors.
Oh, right. Sun down, yeah. in the colors. Yeah, I mean, well, I was always imagining that we were making kind of like a romantic comedy or like a sitcom. And so the actual design of it with the colors and the space and the bright thing was based off of that sort of like sitcom. And then the fact that it almost like looks like a set and all that stuff.
It looks kind of like the set of, I don't know if you've seen Scrubs, the TV show, but Scrubs is it's a dramedy, a very dark comedy, and in one episode they imagine what it would be like as a sitcom, and everything is really pink pastels and so on, and such good feelings, and it's interesting in your movie because both of those things really clash with what's happening.
Yeah. And the scenic designer or the production designer in the movie was somebody who came from theater. So a lot of us have come from the theater, and we were, and a lot of our references are more not like other movies per se, but like visual art and photography and stuff like that. And I was also have been heavily influenced by some of these. Directors who are always kind of who are doing more experimental works or like breaking the fourth wall kind of thing, like Todd Haynes and Abel Ferrara. I mean, there are actually really specific references to both of them in the movie, which I'll not reveal. but that's all sort of like when you're making a movie. For me, it's not like oh, I'm doing a shot like this movie or that. But it just, the influences kind of just flow through all the stuff that I've consumed over the years respond to. So it was all very, very much designed, and we shot on the Alexa camera, which is, you know, a lot of low budget movies, they shoot on like, you know, smaller cameras or these things, but I love
Alexa is a big one. I know jack shit about that.
Oh, Alexa is, it's like a 35 millimeter camera, you know, it's big and it's, but the image it creates is like really lush, very beautiful. And so that's why we kind of chose that camera to do it. But then to sort of break that up a little bit by, you know, going handheld. The whole movie's not handheld. The idea was it was supposed to be very static at the beginning. And then as we go along, it's kind of the camera work responds to that stuff. And it's a version of like what Steven Soderbergh does, like in Traffic, where each of the different places was kind of a different, you know, tint. So, and then there was, which sometime soon we're going to release, but there's a whole dance sequence.
Yeah, I want to see that dance sequence.
That was kind of influenced a lot by, like, Matthew Barney. Do you know Matthew Barney? He's, like, a visual artist, filmmaker.
No. What did he make?
The Cremaster series.
I don't know.
He comes from the art world, but he makes these amazing films. And anyways, we have this dance, because originally in the beginning in the writing of this, the character was really obsessed with pop music.
Okay.
Which that was kind of like when you're making a low budget movie, you have to like, you don't have the money to like option like big pop songs like that we actually wrote into the script. So that sort of kind of drifted off to the side of this. But we did have this where she's imagining herself in this kind of fantasy like dance scene, like a music video, and it was shot like a music video.
Yeah.
So anyways, that was immediately cut from the movie. It looked great. It had this beautiful like a design to it, but it just didn't work at all in the context of what we were doing. But it was so great that I edited it separately. as like okay. in the style of like the 90s when they had like a theme song for a movie and then they would like cut in scenes from the actual film. Cool. So
when are you releasing it?
It should be soon, and the next, it's been done for a while, and it features an original song that we wrote.
Oh, that's cool. Who's the singer?
Mary.
Seriously?
Yeah, she actually is a singer. She was like a trained like opera singer and all that.
Okay.
And so it's her vocals, and the person who wrote the music for it is Jonathan Snipes, who did the score and the sound design for the movie. And we did previously this musical project called Patty, and so when we were going into this, I wanted to do beyond the sort of how it related to the story. I was interested in doing like one of those sequences in like in Body Double. Have you seen Body where there's the Frankie Goes to Hollywood relax sequence?
I'm not sure.
Well, anyways, there's a part of the movie where all of a sudden it sort of like transforms into a music video.
What's in the name of the movie again?
Body Double. It's by Brian De Palma.
No, I haven't seen it. No.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's this scene in it where, like, he gets obsessed with this woman who's a porn star, and so he goes to this, like, club, and when he goes in, this music, like, starts up, and then Frankie Goes to Hollywood, like, appears, and there's this whole sort of, like, one of those. So when we were doing this project, I wanted to do something like that with an original track that we would write that would be basically like a pop song where all the lyrics are super dark and it's basically about binging and purging. It's like a song about binging and purging that's written as a like Britney Spears, like, you know, actually more like old style. Like,
I'm a big pop music fan. To admit, so I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, and this is, we'll definitely have this, and hopefully with the soundtrack for the movie, we're gonna do either as, and maybe both, as a tape and a vinyl.
Oh yeah, please do vinyl.
That's what we're hoping.
I love the score, so I thought, oh my god, it would be so good if the Mondo, you know, Mondo Tease, if they did. I have the release of the awesome mixtape from Guardians of the Galaxy, and I have the one for Gravity, both in vinyl.
Oh yeah.
And I was thinking, oh my god, they could make such perfect artworks for Excess Flesh. That would be so cool.
Well, Jonathan, who scored other movies, he has had a few vinyl releases through both Death Waltz Records and the other one, which I can't, Waxwork Records. And so there was vinyl releases of his score for Starry Eyes.
Okay, I haven't seen Starry Eyes yet, but...
I have not seen Starry Eyes either. because he scored both, people link it. And there's also a vinyl release of Room 237, which is the dark conspiracy theory movie about The Shining.
Yeah, which I haven't seen either, and I've had it on my computers for months.
Yeah, you have to see it. The guy who did Room 237, Rodney, is a friend of mine. He also did this movie from this year that played at South by Southwest and has played a lot of, I think it was at NEEF. It's called The Nightmare. It's about sleep paralysis.
If it was at the NEEF, I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay.
Oh my god.
It might have not played there. I don't.
Because sleep paralysis is like one of the most terrifying stuff in the world.
And this movie's all about it's a documentary, but done in his like style of it's almost like a horror movie. It's like a horror movie.
Okay.
You know, but it's real.
Yeah, great. Okay, so in the movie, you turn both text and food, which are key components of social interactions, into very solitary activities.
Mm-hmm.
You also create like a link between sex and food through, for example, the contest that mimics reality TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
So to what extent did that influence the way you shot them?
Shot the sequences?
Yeah. If you want to talk about that relationship between the two.
I think both of them are sort of, what we were imagining with the character who I realized was actually kind of like a mirror of myself and my sort of, you know, feelings about that thing. I think I think food and sex are very, very connected because they're messy and, you know, there's been many great movies that I've seen. I can't remember the movies that are about that. They're about food and sex. It was important. I really originally wanted to do like an NC-17 version of this movie where it was a lot more, and there was stuff cut out that kind of, you know, went further into that. It was kind of to show it, you know, in this kind of lush, you know, with this lush camera, but the contents of it were, you know, twisted a little bit. And that's what I really like. It's like a sweet spot of the grotesque and beauty and how both of those are kind of, you know, tied together. And I think that that's a lot like what sex and food are. You know, it's like this grotesque sort of action, but it's also very connective and, you know, beautiful, and it's both things that we need, you know.
Definitely.
It's like basically we need sleep, we need food, and we need sex.
I think we need sex and food more than we need sleep.
Well, yeah. Yeah, people like us, we don't sleep.
Something I found deeply accurate about the sex scene is how often past sexual abuse can come back out of nowhere and ruin everything. Once again, that's unexpected coming from a man, even if male also suffer from sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you put it in there, or rather, how did you think of it?
A lot of it had to do with, you know, doing a lot of research into the into eating disorders and, you know, and how these are these sort of extreme physicalizations of these mental states. I got a little off track there. It is early in the morning.
Sexual abuse.
Oh, sexual abuse. Yes, sexual abuse. A lot of the sort of research and the books that I was reading, which were like first person accounts. There's a great book called Wasted. That's about this, and it's kind of written in this sort of diaristic form. We're hinting at that, and it was kind of an extreme sort of way of showing how all of these different sort of social and cultural and sort of things, you know, influence and build one's psychology, right? Really, and this idea of trauma, you know, building, you know, adding, being another layer and, you know, and of influence. So that's kind of where that emerged from, like all the other sort of parts of this. And it was really, really important, like when we had that, the sequence where she's being raped.
I definitely agree, because a lot of people called it gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such a key component. It's a movie. It's the part where you get so much more about the character. You understand something really deep and important to the character when you see it.
Yeah, and it's in the context of this dream sequence, and the way that dreams kind of take pieces of your life and sort of shape in this alternate narrative, and how it's something that starts as, you know, really, really beautiful or whatever, can turn really ugly. And then that's like the idea again, connecting it to sort of sex, you know, and her sort of, and how that's like physicalized in her. And because what happens is in the movie, she's, you know, masturbating while she's sleeping, and this kind of like leads into that thing, you know, her feelings of, like, what's doing this physicalization as she's kind of like falling asleep, how that kind of pulls into the dream.
The movie takes its time to get going.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I have to point out this question has been written by my co-host.
Well.
Antoine. He's not imaginary, even if our name begins with the same letter. Antoine is a real person. So the movie takes its time to get going and even sets up a feeling of routine in Jill's life.
Mm-hmm.
Was that intended, or just a consequence of establishing the situation clearly?
oh no, that was very, you know, much a part of it, you know, yeah. to kind of move into this, it's this episodic, you know, kind of repetition of it, because that's the kind of feeling I get from like sitcoms, is like it moves, you know, in one thing in one way for like three episodes, and then it repeats, it goes through this kind of like cycle. So yeah, and the longer cut of the movie, there's even more sort of time that's sort of taken. So you,
because people would have hated the other cut of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it goes in a way that is very, it's about time and duration and like how these things kind of like influence it, and then all of a sudden, you know, like that's the thing too about tension and all that, you know, it's like slowly like sort of pulling the rubber band back, and then ooh, when it's really all the way back, boom, tension, you know.
I was very puzzled by the inclusion of Jill's mother in the movie, very touched as well, of course, but I didn't quite get what you wanted to say through this. Can you help me a little on that? Is it also the trauma part?
Yeah, this mother character is kind of unreal in the way that she kind of like lives in this alternate reality. She lives in a soap opera, and that's what she becomes.
Yeah.
So it's that sort of, that sort of familial influence that sort of has shaped the character. This having this mother who's not there, who's not present, or doesn't understand her in some way, and the pressures and expectations that her family is putting on her, it was you know, important to show. And it was also good comic relief too, you know, because it was written as you know, this real mixture of like a kind of a romantic comedy and this dark, you know, thriller, these kind of things colliding with each other.
Yeah. Well, comic relief, I will challenge you on that, but
to me, the comedy part.
No, but it's because of past trauma.
Yeah.
So, what was the creative process behind your use of sound design? That's also an Antoine question.
Mm-hmm.
What was the creative process behind your use of sound design to represent Jill's mental state? To me, that's my part. That's what I added. To me, it highlighted the isolation and the feeling of being trapped. Was it intended? Was that accurate at all, what I just said?
Yeah. I mean, the sound design was very, very specific, and I've worked with Jonathan, who did this for many, many years, and we've done a lot of sound design in theater, kind of the idea of sound as a scenic.
Yeah.
And also sort of, because a lot of the works that I do are about these kind of, basically this single consciousness that's like split across all these different spaces and characters. And we've done that before, this kind of emergence of a representation of a psychological sort of state in a sonic space. And then also how music kind of interweaves with that, so there's not it becomes musical, and then the actual music becomes sound design. So that was really outlined, and because Jonathan and I have been working together for so long, mostly I just hand it off and he would understand it and create this thing, because in the movie actually there's only 30 minutes of music, the rest of it is all sound design.
Okay.
Like what's termed as music.
Okay.
Though I think the whole movie is has a symphony.
It has a musicality. Through the whole movie. Yeah.
Yeah, and being very specific about music, because in a lot of movies, it's just the music just leads the audience along. You know, tells them how to feel, and we always kind of want to go against that.
Yeah, it really feels like a character in itself.
Yeah.
The music and the sound.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I know you've just been to Amsterdam, mm-hmm. and the first thing I thought about it, given the movie you just met, when you told me about it, I was wondering how you perceived the red light district.
Well, the thing that I like, because in the U.S. we're so prudish, and you know, I've always been interested in sexuality and you know, which is this kind of shameful thing, you know, that Americans are supposed to feel bad about. And also, what was interesting to me about the Red Light District is how this idea has sort of like transformed, you know, over into like, because now pornography and these types of things are their own like private, you know, sort of things instead of public things. So that the Red Light District somewhat sort of keeps it alive, but it's also been kind of what I feel sort of like stripped back, you know. So it was. So I love being in a place like that, and also and also love really seedy, you know, sort of.
Okay.
And it has, and it's not really seedy anymore. Like it's not like, and I doubt in its day that there was anything like 42nd Street in New York, you know, which was, you know, this really dangerous sort of place to be, where they had all the grindhouses and stuff.
I was so horrified when I went to Amsterdam. I was horrified by the red light. Like really such an exploitative place.
It is.
It's horrifying.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's why
like
I go there.
It's a fucking human zoo.
It is. Well, it's not so much anymore, but in a way, yes, and it's also a tourist trap.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what it gives you too is there's this permissiveness and there's this freedom, you know.
Yeah.
And the marijuana, you just the coffee shops, you just go in and, you know, you go up to the bar and you just order from a menu.
Well, I moved to Colorado.
Yeah. Well, it's even more like there's not in the U.S. like, and there won't be for probably hundreds of years, but like a restaurant, you know, like a coffee shop where you walk in and you can.
I so hope that there will.
Yeah.
In Switzerland, at least. I really hope that Switzerland gets there fast.
My belief is that if drugs were legalized, you know, it would cut down on crime.
Will gain us money.
Mm-hmm. Totally. It would institutionalize
it. If politicians want something, it's money. So just legalize. But
there you go.
Also, if pot was legalized, we could research on it for mental illness and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
We could do so much good if only pot was legalized.
Yeah.
That was the 420 part of the podcast. What are your thoughts on the way mental illnesses are depicted in the media and movies nowadays?
How are women depicted? I mean,
mental illnesses.
Oh, mental illness.
Yeah, mental illness.
I don't think it is depicted most of all, or you know, it's one of the last things that people don't want to talk about.
Have you seen Silver Lining Playbook for?
Yeah, I can't stand that.
Oh, I can't stand it either. I have a bipolar friend who loves it, but I personally I can't stand it. To me, it was so. Such a fucking lie.
Yeah, I don't think it's really an accurate representation at all.
A lot of bipolar people found it accurate.
No?
Yeah, and I was surprised. I was like, oh my god, they are fucking lucky.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it has something in it, but it's just not, there's not really, it uses it to get at something, a different idea.
The manic is the manic pixie dream girl of the movie.
The what?
You know what manic pixie dream girls are?
Oh, yeah.
The bipolar disorder, which includes manic phases, is the manic pixie dream girl of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's just not... And I'm always interested in that, you know. You know, how these, you know, mental states of being, how they can be represented in ways that leave the, you know, are not, like, positive or, like, uplifting, but just... give people an understanding of how these things work, and so I'm always trying to sort of do that. And you don't see that. I don't see that a lot. It's just it's used as, you know, either for a different purpose or it's sort of damned in a way.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah,
we need more movie about mental illnesses and mental health in general.
Because that's mostly, I mean, that's what this movie is about.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And people say, oh, it's eating disorders and that and this and that. And
it's not only eating disorders.
No,
it's... To me, it didn't spoke to me on the level of eating disorders, except maybe for the trouble eating with other people. But to me, yeah, it spoke to a lot of other mental states I've been in. Which are not all directly connected to one particular illness.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of crossover between Prince and Jim.
I know you've been kind of touring through the world, well, America and Europe at least, screening your movie. What are your best and worst experiences on the road, so to speak?
I've not really had any bad experiences.
Seriously?
I don't think so. I mean, each place has its own sort of like character, and it's really interesting to go to these places, especially, you know, the places that I haven't been. So I don't have, it's all been positive. Knock on wood, you know, up until now.
And dude, that's not wood.
This is wood. Well, no, it's not. It has to be. It's not plastic. And it's really great to see the different responses to the movie in the different sort of places. That's why I like going and to see, I mean, that's a big thing.
Have you had some places who had like, was the general consensus specific to each places, or was it always kind of evened out in the way people received your movie?
It has been different, very much in the different places that we've been, and it's also that. It's also these festivals too. It's interesting to see how the different festivals operate and you know how they've programmed this and how it works within their programming. So because all of them are so different, but they're also all the very similar too.
Yeah.
I wouldn't pick favorites, but I really love the genre festival because what. The genre fest include is, you know, movies that are different.
Yeah.
You know, whereas in most festivals, it's just this idea of, you know, this proper film. You know, and in America, it's bad independent cinema, basically.
Okay. The next question was going to ask you what was your favorite film festival, so I won't ask that. can you tell our audience about the Adam Sandler situation?
I've been working on this series of what happens is I get really obsessed with one thing at a certain time. I don't know why. There were these different things telling me that I needed to actually like really deal with Adam Sandler.
I learned lock picking last year, so I understand the getting obsessed part.
Yeah, I mean it was weird how it just kind of like took over my mind, and I realized that. The question was that I hated him so bad, but I've never seen any of the movies. I don't. It's just based on this manufactured idea that I was holding on to since I was 15 years old and thought that it was beneath me, you know, or whatever. Because those movies were coming out when I was the target audience, but I was seeing like, you know, Candyman or like Bonnie and Clyde, you know.
I was seeing Candyman, but I was also seeing Adam Sandler. I was way younger.
Yeah. But no, he hasn't changed though.
I mean,
what was the first Adam Sandler movie you saw?
The first Adam Sandler movie I saw, it was
The Waterboy.
No, I think it was Happy Gilmore.
The what? Oh, Happy Gilmore.
Yeah.
But you didn't see it when it came out.
No, I saw it on DVD. DVD. Or maybe it was Waterboy. Maybe it was Little Nicky went came later.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it must have been... Or maybe it was Big Daddy.
Uh-huh. Big Daddy's great.
Well, I don't know if I would still like it, because I'm pretty sure there's a lot of fucking sexist stuff in it, but...
Oh, all of his movies are about it. The role of... I haven't gotten to that part yet, but the role of women in the Adam Sandler movies is very, very questionable, and also says a lot about, you know, how Hollywood works and how the culture sort of, you know, shapes these things. So yeah, but I realized that, you know, because I can always pull some bit of something out of every movie. I don't think there's any movie that I haven't been able to find something in. And so that's why I wanted to sort of like go back here and try to just reckon with it, you know. And thus far, I've just been blown away. Like, I've loved everything.
Seriously?
I've loved everything. Because, yeah, except
even Click!
Click is great! I just wrote them.
I'm a fan of his early work, you know. So yeah.
But Clicker extends off of that, and I thought it has a like melancholy to it.
Yeah,
you know, because
I like that, but it wasn't as good as Happy Gilmore. It wasn't as good as The Waterboy. It wasn't.
I haven't gotten to The Waterboy yet.
You haven't?
I've never watched The Waterboy.
Well, to me, my favorite one will always be Funny People, and it's not really an Adam Sandler movie. It's a movie about Adam Sandler, which is named different, who's named differently in the movie, but it's about Adam Sandler, and it's a fan fiction about, oh, what if Adam Sandler got cancer? Which is a fan fiction that a lot of us can relate to, I think.
Right, yeah.
So,
but that's an interesting thing, this idea, and I want to look at that too, is that when is it an Adam Sandler movie and when is it not? And what's interesting is with Funny People is Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
And Judd Apatow is very specific, you know, sort of style. And so he did that, and then recently there was the Amy Schumer
I haven't been able to see it yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird movie because it's this combination of a Judd Apatow movie with this Amy Schumer character.
Yeah.
So is it an Amy Schumer movie or is it a Judd Apatow movie?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's both.
Yeah, I really liked the last season of her show, the third season.
Uh-huh.
But before that, I felt like she was focusing too much like on sex and kind of frat boy jokes. But now she's become a great feminist voice, so it's that's why I'm really interested to see that movie.
Yeah,
but I wrote kind of a negative backlash against it.
That
it was really anti-feminist and so on.
It actually kind of, you know, turns into, as a lot of the Judd Apatow movies, this kind of like, you know, the whole like nuclear, you know, the conventional idea of you get married and you know whatever, and I was like hoping it was going to be something else because it was going in that direction, and then it becomes that like all you're going to, you know, like women have to marry and you know, this whole sort of idea, which was unfortunate.
Yeah, we were always trapped there.
Yeah.
I can't remember which movie, or maybe it was a TV show. Oh yes, it was How I Met Your Mother. Which ended recently. It was the 6 or 7 last years were, no, 6 years, 6 or 5 last years were terrible, but I kept watching it, and for the finale with one of my dear friends who lives in Los Angeles, we were always criticizing the show on Twitter, so we decided that we were going to watch the last season together on Skype. So he watched it at 2 a.m. and I watched it at 9 a.m. in Switzerland.
Wait, how do you do that? How do you watch movies?
We launched the movie, TV show at the same time. And so for the final episode, we decided that we were going to do a drinking game with champagne. And so we wrote this great list, and I had made like a year before the end of the show, I had made a list of predictions that of what was going to happen. And so that would have, that was a drink the whole flute, and basically after 10 minutes of the episode we were already 3 glasses in. So yeah, and it was 9 a.m. for me and I hadn't eaten anything, so it was a really hard couple of days.
I did a drinking game for like a year ago when I was in Iceland. They had a drinking game for Tremors. Have you ever seen that movie?
No.
It's about like the snakes that are underground, giant snakes that go underground
out
of American Southwest. It's goofy. It's a Kevin Bacon movie.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those, and they've made like 4 of them since then.
Okay.
But like there's particular things in that movie, because it's kind of like a cult classic, and you had to take a drink every time, and after that I was like because I probably did like we were doing actually like shots too.
Oh my god.
And like you had to do it every time, and there was like 40 times in that movie.
We did that as well for Grey's Anatomy's Grey's Anatomy
you know,
final.
There's a Grey's Anatomy drinking game.
We created it too with my friends.
Okay.
Right before, because we wanted to get shit faced, so it was the best way to go. Okay, so last question. You work with a lot of different art supports, like movies, music videos, documentaries, theater. What's your favorite one? Do you have a favorite one?
No, because each one is its own different sort of thing and process, and there's different things that I get out of each. I mean, I've always wanted to be a filmmaker. I mean, that film and cinema is the thing I love because it's, I feel it's the greatest combination of all the things, visual art, theater, you know, literature. When you're working, like in theater, for example, theater is about the process. It's not about the end result. In movies, it's more about that object. And theater, since it's so fleeting, it's about the process of building it.
Yeah.
And seeing this thing that you know is just going to go away.
Yeah.
And so it's super exhausting, and sometimes you have that feeling like, you know, I've spent 2 years working on this thing, and we're going to have 9 performances, and it's going to be gone, you know?
Yeah.
And you can never do it justice on video.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, if you videotape it. So that's where, with film, you have this, it's like this concrete object that will live on and can travel and have a broader audience. So I think I prefer most doing film, especially narrative. Less music videos and all that stuff are great for like experimentation, but I'm most interested in narrative and also representing it and film and feature films.
Yeah,
you know. Because it's a dying art form now because of the series. You know, it really is. You know, just this 2 hour or less or sometimes more entertainment that's like there's a whole arc of something that goes on in it instead of, you know, whatever. But more and more it feels like people want that. They want this longer sort of investigation of something. But I think there's something really special about film being like a sculpture in a way. You know? Not a... a ribbon or something.
I see. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Kennelly and Aisha Kotman for Nobody Cares on Radio Kawa. Yeah. Bye.